Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our retreat. And it's a great pleasure to introduce Armin Ball as our first plenary speaker today. Many of you know Armin, but for those who don't, he's relatively recently arrived from Harvard University and is a tenure-track professor in neurobiology and zoology here at the university, and is also an Emmy Noether Fellow. He has an Emmy Noether group here. And so, as I mentioned, he was at Harvard prior to coming to Konstanz, working with Florian Engert on the neurobiology of zebrafish. Prior to that, he did his PhD with Axel Borst at the Max Planck on Drosophila neurobiology. And prior to that, he was in Berlin, and I think you did your undergraduate degree in physics.
Computational neuroscience.
And Armin has been really central in creating the focus here in this particular building, in the labs here, on behavior and neurobiology. And he's also got one of the most dynamic and interactive young groups here at the university. So it's a great pleasure to have you speak to us today, Armin, to kick this things off.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Thanks a lot for giving me the opportunity to talk. And welcome, everyone, to this spring retreat of our cluster. For me, it's the first time to kind of talk here in person and to see many of you, and I'm really looking forward to the next few days kind of to hang out with you and have a beer in the evening and chat really one-to-one. It's really, really exciting this is happening again. Okay, so I'm delighted then to present my work on what and our division of our lab and how we plan kind of bring together two kind of often rather distinct disciplines, kind of the study of animal behavior and collective behavior and neuroscience. And so animals, so I hear some, wait a second. Okay. So animals live in highly dynamic groups and in a very complex environments and have to make decisions all the time. When navigating, when foraging, kind of when searching for food, when kind of trying to escape from predators. And during such, exactly. But so kind of during the studies, the individual animal kind of doing this behavior. Obviously, kind of the individual animal's nervous system is processing the sensory environment, kind of in complicated ways. Is trying to remember things. It's kind of associating this with, kind of with its internal state, and then creating behavior. And what we think is that the animal is just kind of using actually relatively simple computations, kind of to transform the sensory environment into behavior. It's summing from different information channels. It may kind of employ nonlinear operations or simply low-pass filtering the signals. So, and kind of while this approach is very kind of successful and powerful in cognitive psychology, kind of describing complicated kind of behavioral transformations with relatively simple algorithmic rules, kind of the question remains kind of how these computations, how these algorithms are actually implemented on the level of the nervous system, which has to operate kind of in the regime of biology, has to operate with neurons, which have dendrites, which have axons, which operate with action potentials, which form complicated dense neural nets. And kind of the link between kind of the algorithms of behavior and sensory integration and the neural basis thereof is still relatively poorly understood. And kind of even more complicated, well, we know that animals are rarely doing these computations in isolation. So normally they are making decisions in rather crowded groups, which then creates an additional layer of complexity where the behavior of an individual is actually affecting massively the sensory environment of everyone else, and where the behavior, kind of just the group context by itself, may indeed modulate kind of the way how individuals are processing information also massively. So, and one hope is that kind of from kind of a bottom-up approach that we can trying to focus kind of on the focal animal and trying to understand kind of its visual and sensory surround and trying to understand how it's processing all the sensory cues in its environment, that in principle we should be able through computational modeling kind of make predictions of the complex emergent properties of collective behavior. So but let's go back to the individual. So we first actually need to understand how the individual brain is transforming sensory input into behavior. And so what has been a very popular approach in many fields in neuroscience and in cognitive psychology is so-called integration to bound models, in which animals and humans are often integrating kind of the evidence about a certain sensory cue over time towards a certain decision threshold. And when that threshold is reached, the animal then makes a certain motor movement. And this has been studied intensively kind of in the early 90s, where people said, okay, how can we formalize this and how can we simplify this paradigm such that we kind of have a binary readout? We don't want to ask the animal complicated questions about its perception. And what people have been able to is training monkeys to use saccadic eye movements to report their perception of motion direction in a cloud of randomly flickering and moving dots, which is a relatively a challenging task for us and for the monkey. And by having this binary readout, right or left, one could do a perceptual decision-making task with those animals. And now I'm going to show you this stimulus, and then kind of you are going to do my test subject now. I think it's going to be relatively easy for people here, but probably very difficult for people on Zoom. Because of video compression. So there's this cloud of randomly moving dots, and please let me know as soon as you see which is the direction of motion. Just shout out. Left, very good. So this is 40% coherence. And the beauty about that stimulus, you can very nicely vary the difficulty of the task by playing around with the noise, by playing around with the fraction of coherence, without affecting other features like contrast or speed. So I can now switch to a kind of more challenging one where it's 20% coherence, and then please let me know again which is the direction of motion you perceive. To the right, okay, good. So, and of course you can imagine I can make this as difficult as I want until you're gonna miserably fail. And so if I would do this, so what I would find with you and what people found with primates is that with increasing levels of coherence, your probability of correctly responding increases, and with increasing levels of coherence, your response delay decreases. And this does make a lot of sense if you think in terms of these integrator models, because so for low levels of coherence, you have kind of this slow, kind of noisy increase towards the threshold. And because of the noise, you're sometimes also going to the wrong direction and will make a wrong decision. And because of the noise, it will take a while to reach the decision threshold. So correctness should be low and response delay should be high. But if you switch to kind of higher levels of coherence, kind of the signal and noise, signal to noise is much more in your favor. So you will reach the threshold much earlier. And because and you will be making less mistakes, so the probability of correctly responding should increase and the response delay should decrease. So it's a very simple model which has been very powerful in predicting many aspects of human and animal decision-making behavior. And what's also really nice about this model is that over the last few years, people have started to explore kind of a neural representation of these integrators. And they are found everywhere. So people found them with electrophysiology recordings in mice, in monkeys, and also with EEG recordings in humans. But of course, kind of with any of those systems, it's really hard to move further, to really ask kind of how are these kind of algorithms implemented? Is this happening just in that particular location of where people have recorded from? Is this probably a brain-wide phenomena, et cetera, et cetera? So what we were hoping for, so this was what I've done during my postdoc with Florian Engert. What we were hoping for is that we can find a much simpler model, or a much simpler system, a model organism which is genetically tractable and where we have access to the entire brain, and ask, can perhaps an animal as simple as the larval zebrafish also perform that cognitive task? And for this system, we do have a rich toolkit of molecular genetic tools. We can label individual neurons of particular cell types. It's very easy to make transgenic lines for reporting neural activity. And kind of because the animal is tiny and transparent, it is straightforward to use standard microscopy to characterize the neural activity of the entire nervous system at cellular resolution. And another advantage of that system, it comes with an innate intrinsic report of its perception. So while I was telling you that for the monkey, the animal needed to be trained to report the motion direction, the zebrafish is born with a report of its perception, which is called the optomotor response. And the optomotor response is a very important behavior, which the animals show the moment they are presented with global motion drift. So they normally follow motion drift in their surrounding, which is thought to be important for course control during involuntary drifts in moving streams. And so we take this behavior and now bring this to our lab. And how we study this is, so we've built these high throughput, high resolution tracking systems in which we can present the small larvae with arbitrarily complicated visual scenes presented from below. At the same time, we do track the animal and know at every moment in time its orientation and its position, which lets us make conclusions about its decision-making behavior. And thanks to support from the cluster, we were actually able to scale this up by a factor of 4 now, which now will allow us to really move on with high throughput behavioral characterization of our animals. Okay, and here's a zoom in how this looks. So now let's focus on the left fish here. So you see this tiny fish here, it's swimming, it's being tracked from above with the camera. And now we present this visual scene. Now in this case, it's a a moving grating being locked to the body orientation of the fish, which forces the animal to constantly swim in leftward circles. So this is the type of behavior experiment which the system allows us to do. We can also embed animals in, we can head restrain animals by embedding the head in transparent agarose, free the tail, remove the agarose around the tail again, which then allow us to use the same system with the camera to do high resolution tracking of the tail movement, which gives us ultimate control of the visual stimulation and the behavioral response. So which now means in this behavior configuration, we can present these very same visual stimuli, these randomly moving dots, which are presented to the monkey, while the animal is fixed in place, like a monkey sitting on its chair, being forced to stare at the screen. And the poor fish is now forced to stare at that stimuli. And what you see, it's integrating and integrating and integrating, and at some point, it's doing a tail flick to the right, which we interpret as decision-making event, and which then allows us to score the delay of the response and the correctness of the response. And now when we characterize this as a level of coherence, what we find is that the fraction of correct responses increases and that the response delay decreases with increasing levels of coherence, which looks very much alike to what I've shown you in the classical primate behavioral work. And now sometimes the animal freaks out. Okay, so, and what the system also allows us to do, which is really powerful, is, so this was the head fixed animal, but you may want to know, is this also relevant when the animal is freely swimming around in the more natural setting? So because we we can track the animal in real time, what we can also do is closing the loop. So we know at every moment in time where the animal is, we know at every moment in time how it's oriented. So this allows us to, with a very short delay, link the visual stimulation to what the animal is doing, and thereby presenting stimuli to the animal constantly over time, which is an important property if you want to ask, is the animal integrating those cues? Because if you need to present them you need to link them to the animal and need to present them constantly over time in order to address this. So, and this is a little cartoon of how this is looking like. So you have a freely swimming fish which is moving randomly in the arena, but it is no matter where it is, no matter how it's oriented, the stimulus will always move to the left in closed loop, forcing the animal then to swim in leftward circles. And so here, this is an example how this looks like for these randomly moving dots moving to the left. So the animal is seeing this and it's starting to turn to the left. And here's an example for rightward motion, so the animal is seeing this and swimming to the right. And now the question, so if the animal is capable of temporally integrating this information, then its behavior should change over time. If it would just respond to the momentary a motion cue, then it would just go up, turn to the right with a certain probability, but remain constant. And indeed, what we find is, in particular for low levels of coherence, for 25%, that it takes kind of the animal from the onset of the motion stimulus, here the gray box, it takes the animal 5 to 6 seconds to actually reach its maximum performance, really indicating that the animal is capable of integrating those motion cues in the environment. And so from this, we conclude that, kind of inspired by the classical primate stimulus and the experimentation, we find that also a simple system as the larval zebrafish is capable of integrating these cues, and that classical models like these drift diffusion models, these integrator models to abound, are valuable tools to explaining the behavior. Okay, so what we are now trying to do is asking, well, it's not only motion in the environment which the animal tries to integrate and tries to make sense of. There's also all kinds of other cues. There is luminance cues. Some areas in the vicinity are brighter or darker. Some areas have a higher contrast. So it's a complex visual scene. And what we try, and the animal always needs to make sense of all of this at the same time. It has conspecifics in the environment and needs to kind of integrate all these information channels and process them at once. And at the end, needs to make one decision whether it's going to the right or to the left. And so this is what Katya is studying. So she tries to add an additional layer of complexity and ask, can the larval zebrafish integrate luminance cues? And to boil this down, so we are asking, is there a central integrator somewhere in the fish which is integrating over time all kinds of sensory processing channels, or are there multiple integrators which are integrating different information channels from different sensor modalities, from different visual processing streams? And then we use modeling to make predictions of what we would expect for the behavior. And so for the convergent model, so let's start now with there's a single integrator. So now let's say there is motion to the left, and then we switch to this luminance cue where the motion stops, and on the left side things are a little brighter. And we know from behavior that the larval zebrafish tends to go into the bright light, so it's attracted to white luminance cues. And now what we are expecting, if this would be a single integrator, then it's integrating kind of the motion cue over time as we've seen before. And now the motion stops and we flip to a luminance cue, which is then also attractive, but a little bit less attractive than the motion cue. So what we're expecting, it should just slowly decay towards a new baseline. In the other case, so if you have two parallel integrators, so now we have the dashed line is now our integrator for motion, so which starts to integrate, and the motion, at the moment the motion stops, it's slowly decaying again. And you have a second integrator here, the dotted line. So first was the dotted line, now comes the dashed line. The dashed line is the integrator of the luminance cue, which initially is zero because there is no asymmetry in the luminance, but then starts to increase again. So now what the animal is doing is that the animal is now superimposing these two systems and making decisions based on these cues, which will lead to this prominent dip in the behavior. And now when we actually do those experiments, with the animal here in the magenta line, what you see, there is this prominent dip in the behavior, which is to us indicating that indeed there seems to be a separate integrator systems which are integrating different visual cues over time. And in another project, we then trying to understand the animal is not only temporally integrating information in the environment, it also needs to make decision about objects in space. And so inspired now by recent work from the cousin lab, where they had an individual fish swimming in a virtual environment, interacting with two virtual conspecifics. And what they find is that as a function of distance to those conspecifics, the animal is switching from an averaging regime to a decision-making regime, choosing one of the equally attractive options. And what we are asking is, can we actually simplify this? Can we bring this concept to our system? Can we bring this concept to our larval zebrafish? And so one idea is to actually go and find attractive cues. And as we know, light is attractive. Now we can present the animal with two equally attractive luminance cues in the environment. And Max developed strategies to, through motion cues, to position the animal at a certain kind of place in the arena, and then start the trial by presenting relative to the field of view those luminance cues, and then see how the animal makes its decision as a function of distance to those cues. And so this is relatively early still, and now we have the kind of room for exploring these features. So what you see is if he has two kind of equally attractive discs, and now he can kind of move them further and further apart as a function of from the perspective of the fish, then you see that kind of the moment here the discs are relatively close together, the animal seems to kind of rather go in between these two cues, and the moment he kind of moves them further and further apart, kind of this kind of more decision-making regime appears, which indicates that indeed such simplified configuration allow us to reproduce kind of the work from the cousin lab in a completely different visual context. Okay, and so this was all about individual behavior. So what about now the collective? So one thing which is important to notice that at that age, when the animal is still very young, when the animal is still a larvae, it's very minimally interacting with conspecifics. So here, when it's 7 days post-fertilization, if you test multiple animals, they are relatively ignorant towards each other, but relatively quickly. So when the animal is becoming 2 weeks old, and then it's kind of fully established when the animal is 3 weeks old, they start to be very strongly attracted to one another. So a requirement is for kind of studying kind of social interactions and collective behavior is that we and kind of the entire field of zebrafish neuroscience is somehow moving forward to older animals which show these behaviors. And what has been really nice is we could now in these two different regimes, from the young animal and the old animal, we were able then to record kind of the visual field of the focal animal and project every other animal to kind of to the retina of this central animal, and then just make predictions of what the kind of turning probability of the central animal is as a function of how much space has been occupied on the retina, which we call clutter. So, and what we find is that for the young animal, when there is a lot of clutter on the left, the probability of turning right is high, and when there is a lot of clutter on the right, the probability of turning to the left is high, which would now mean the animal should actually actively avoid conspecifics in its environment. While if the animal is becoming older, then that curve massively changes. So when there's more clutter on the right, the animal turns to the right. When there's more clutter on the left, the animal will turn to the left, which means the animal is attracted to structures in the environment. And the nice thing is kind of this is now bringing kind of the idea of social attraction to kind of something very simple. This is spatial contrast. It's just likes structures. And the question was, can this then explain the emergent phenomena of collective behavior? And we did simple agent-based simulations kind of with these rules where the animal is kind of perceiving clutter on the left and the right. And what this model simulation shows us very nicely is that for the young zebrafish, then they are not interacting with another, or they more like actually repel each other. And for the older animal, which is attracted to these clutter structures, they start to swim together, which is for us really looks like a kind of realistic collective behavior at that age. So it may be that indeed it's simply a kind of this spatial clutter which is explaining these emergent phenomena. And so it's not only that social behavior emerges when the animal is getting older. It's actually, there's a lot of exciting cognitive abilities which rapidly develop over the early time course of the early development. So while in the young larvae, I've shown you they have an optomotor response, they can swim to light, they can already hunt. We've shown that they can temporally integrate information and make simple decisions. But just a little 2 weeks later, they already make these spatial decisions, follow conspecifics. They are very attracted to others, so they show social behavior, and they show associative learning. And when the animal gets older, it can even do more complicated tasks. So, and for the kind of for the juvenile work, kind of recently, kind of people have started to look at its learning abilities, and there's a very nice work from the lab of Herwig Bayer in Munich, where they conditioned kind of in a T-shaped arena with electric shock a certain pattern, and what they see after conditioning for kind of up to half an hour, that the animal then actively avoids kind of these structures, which indicate that at that age they can very nicely learn. And what's also really interesting, normally the larval zebrafish, I've told you, is following motion cues in the environment. So it's when presented with kind of moving gratings to the right, it does rightward turns. When it's presented with moving gratings to the left, it does leftward turns. And what we find kind of in some preliminary experiment is that when we switch to slightly older animals, kind of these dynamics change massively. So rather than following the motion cue, the animal actually occasionally seems to swim actively against this. And this is really kind of challenging the whole idea of the optomotor response and its stabilization mechanisms, and indicates that the behavior is becoming more goal-oriented, that the animal probably starts to actively seek stimuli in the environment, the animal actively tries to find food, etc. And what's really nice with the system we've built is that it's readily applicable to exploring all those behaviors, which are, to be honest, are very poorly explored. I mean, there is a lot of behavioral work in the larvae, but almost none at that behavioral stage, so we know almost nothing. So it's really exciting that here we have now the opportunity to do this with the systems we have. And now some very simple questions we can now ask with the juveniles is, can also juveniles temporally and spatially integrating sensory cues? And kind of to bring this in the kind of collective behavior context, now we can kind of bring multiple animals together because we know they are socially interacting, and ask kind of how these decision-making behaviors are modulated by the presence and the decision-making of their peers. Okay, so far now I've talked about behavior. So this is, I've just talked about these type of equations, kind of the cognitive abilities of the animals to transform sensory environments into behavior. But we as a neurobiology lab, we are of course also interested in the mechanisms and how these computations are implemented within the complicated networks of neurons. And here kind of comes a little problem, because, so now here the rightward bar here indicates the accessibility for neuroscience experiments. So while in the larval stage it is very easy and we have a lot of tools for dissecting the nervous system, it is actually, the older the animal becomes, the bigger the animal becomes, the less transparent it becomes, the more difficult it is to head restrain animal. So it's just the accessible for neuroscience experiments goes down rapidly, and we require actually improvements of technology here. But let me first focus on how we do neuroscientific work so far in the larval zebrafish. And what's really important to our work is that we have full control of the imaging technology and the optics. So this is why we build our microscope really from scratch, from ourselves, which gives us full control about the light stimulus, which allows us to scan in deeper structures and a little bit faster, and which also makes the systems much, much cheaper. And it's also a lot of fun. And so we build these microscopes ourselves. And now, thanks to the cluster, we actually got funding to build a second microscope, which allows us to scale up kind of our imaging speed by a lot. And so because we are such a kind of a broad audience, I thought I would doing a step back and explaining kind of the general concept of two-photon microscopy. I mean, why two-photon? What does it mean? What's special about this compared to standard microscopy? So generally what we have is we genetically express a green fluorescent protein in all neurons of the zebrafish. And that protein has been genetically engineered to only be activity dependent. So only if a neuron is active, the neuron will, fluorescent protein will emit green light. So and how we normally excite these green fluorescent proteins is with blue light, kind of the photons is absorbed by this structure, kind of an electron jumps to a higher level, falls back to a lower level and emits a lower energy photon than in green light. Kind of this is the general concept of fluorescence. So a blue photon is absorbed, electron jumps to a higher energy level, falls down, emits green light. Great. So now what's the trick with two-photon microscopy? So with two-photon microscopy, now you're not going in with blue light, but you're going in with light which has half the energy or twice the wavelengths. So that it's not enough energy to excite your electron to jump to the higher to a higher level. So you need two photons arriving kind of at the very same time at that place in order to create this effect. So and why is this important? Why is this exciting? Because so now the kind of the probability of this occurring kind of very much relates to the density of photons. So how much can you focus your light to a particular spot creates light density, and kind of the absorption of this photon happens with a certain probability, which is just p in the case of one photon excitation. But in the case of two photon, these photons have to be there at the same time. So it's kind of the probability of one photon being there times the probability of another photon being there, which means now we have a probability squared, which means now the dependency of this effect is kind of depending not just linearly on the density, but squared on the density, which is having massive kind of implications, because while you with standard wide field microscopy where you shine blue light into a fluorescent sample, what you're seeing is that you're essentially exciting large parts of the sample across the focal point, while into photon microscopy you're really capable of kind of z-slicing and because of the squared dependency kind of massively improve your z resolution. And another advantage of two-photon microscopy, I've said we're using half the energy or twice the wavelengths, and longer wavelengths actually have this convenient property that they are penetrating deeper through scattering tissue, which is very important for us, because if you have large animals and we go through the skin, it's very scattering. So you want the longest wavelengths possible to go deep into your structure. And finally, I think for us, kind of the most important property of two-photon microscopy is actually this one, that we are using infrared light to excite our sample. And infrared light is invisible to us. So 950 nanometers is invisible to us, and it's invisible to the animal, which is fundamental if you want to study visual behaviors, in particular, kind of difficult to distinguish noisy behaviors. And while with kind of standard wide field microscopy, you're shining blue light into the animal and actually you're freaking the animal out a lot. So it has a lot of advantages, and so this is why we use two-photon microscopy. And so I said we have kind of, by setting up the systems kind of from scratch, from individual components, it also allows us to kind of combine imaging with a kind of behavioral recording. So we have a camera under the objective, which then allows us to do high spatial temporal resolution tracking of the tail movement, and then relate these activities to the neural dynamics we observe. And now we've just starting kind of a new way of how to record those behaviors, where we, rather than kind of using a camera to track what the tail is doing, actually switch to an electrophysiological configuration in which we plan to record kind of from the motor nerve endings in a fully paralyzed animal, which kind of should give us the same result, but with ultimate stability of the sample, which will be very critical to bring this technology later to the older animals. And so we also in the system can present visual stimuli. So we show the animal our favorite random dot moving stimulus from below, or now we've kind of managed to also kind of together with our workshop build a build a more kind of realistic three-dimensional system, which will then allow us to also present kind of really inspired by the VR system which Ian has, will allow us to present kind of the scenes in a more immersive way in three dimensions. And here, so we also kind of have to solve simple computational problems. So now here, for example, if you project a visual scene onto a dome structure, you need to distort it in the correct correct way. So it's actually from the perspective of the animal sitting in the middle, kind of looks like what it's kind of realistically. So you need a little bit of need to do a little bit of math, which luckily kind of is all implemented on the graphics cards. So here's a kind of the visual scene, and I don't ask me why I chose a cat and a dog. Made a visual scene of a circular tunnel where the animal should then swim or walk through. And now these kind of spherical projections, now you can imagine if you now wrap this kind of over a dome, then kind of here the checkerboard will be always on the floor and the dog will be always on the right and the cat will be always on the left. So this allows us now to do these transformations properly and present this in the microscope in the correct way. Good, so that's just now kind of the system. It's very technical. And now what you get is from the imaging, you get these kind of beautiful kind of activities in multiple planes of the fish, and you can get tens of thousands of cells responding to your visual stimulus and somehow relate those activity then to the behavior. And so we then also develop strategies to automatically segment these neurons, because we want to know in those images what is a neuron and then extract those signals over time. And here there has been actually massive progress over the last 2 years in segmentation strategies. So what we previously used is kind of just local correlations. So you're trying to find out what is a neuron based on which pixel is correlated to which other pixel. And now there is kind of with the advent of neural networks, and now we're switching to a deep learning approach where kind of a network has been trained to recognize what's actually a cell body and recognizing in the averaged image what are different cell bodies in the environment. And this allows us to massively kind of improve our segmentation quality to now almost kind of, I would say, 100%. And so from there on, so now we get now all these cells which show activity over time the moment the stimulus starts. And now from there, the actually fun part starts, where then through dimensionality reduction methods and complicated clustering strategies, we can then extract kind of what functional cell types are in there and can relate these activity to the stimulus, can relate this activity to the behavior. And kind of going back to the idea of kind of are there different integrators for motion and luminance. So now we did show exactly that stimulus to our little fish, and now imaged here this plane in the fish. And what you see is here these right neurons. When you present motion to the right, then slowly the activity of these red neurons is turning on. And when you present motion, when you present these luminance cues on the right, then you see these blue neurons, which also slowly ramp up. And now going back to the original question, are there one or two integrators? So we can superimpose those and find now these, that for example, here are blue neurons, just blue. There's just red neurons, just red. And there are some magenta neurons, which indicate kind of that these neurons are responding to both. So it's what this means that on that level, very interestingly, you have integrators for motion cues, and you have integrators for luminance cues, and you seem to have kind of a mixed population which is responding to both. And so then in order to statistically quantify this across animals, then we use kind of mapping techniques inspired by what people are using in the fMRI field in cognitive psychology, where we can take multiple brains from multiple animals and map this onto a common reference frame, which then allow us to kind of take those neurons which we identified and map this into kind of brains which we can then rotate in three dimensions and superimpose this with other cell types where we do, for example, know if they are inhibitory or excitatory. And so what else do we do? I mean, now we kind of have those neurons. We know what they are responding to, but eventually you want to know how do they look like, where do they project to, what are the other neurons in the environment, what are the other neurons in the fish brain which they may be connected to. And here, kind of with a heroic effort in with my previous PI, in collaboration with Jeff Lichtman at Harvard University and Google, so what we are trying to do is now we start with the functional imaging where we characterize our neural dynamics and characterize our cell types, and then map kind of those functionally imaged data to kind of high-resolution electron microscopy, which where we have kind of a multiple, I think it's a petabyte of data of the entire larval zebrafish, which then, together with Google and developing automatic segmentation strategies to trace individual neurons from this area. And this allows us to kind of really map kind of functional cell types, and here this is inhibitory and excitatory neurons, kind of from light microscopy to electron microscopy, and then start tracing. And this just has started, and it's kind of really exciting that we are now capable of picking these neurons in this area and start tracing them at electron microscopic resolution and making predictions of who may be connected to what. So we are also kind of attacking kind of the problem of morphology from yet another perspective, kind of not with electron microscopy, but with more physiological tools. So also thanks to the cluster, we could purchase and kind of a new system for electrophysiology, which allows us to kind of, which has enhanced contrast capabilities. And this allows us to go in with a little pipette to our neuron of interest and then perform a method which is called plasmid electroporations. And here, the method is really straightforward. So you fill your electrode with high-concentrated plasmid solution, which will allow the cell to express, for example, a membrane-bound red fluorophore. And then you're presenting at kind of, when once you're near the cell body, you're presenting a quickly oscillating strong electric field, which opens the cell membrane for a tiny little bit. The plasmids get shot into the cell membrane closes again, you take your pipette out, let the fish swim around overnight, and in the next morning, hopefully that plasmid is trapped in an individual cell, starts express, and then what we see is this beautiful morphology of kind of electroporation-targeted neurons. So very powerful tool, which I'm having high hopes for, that this will soon give us a large library of neural morphology of these regions. And eventually, kind of all this information, it's really kind of collecting knowledge about these structures, Now we kind of, what we are collaborating with is a group in Berlin, which is making a multi-feature atlas of the larval zebrafish brain, where we can upload our functional imaging data, where we can upload the electron microscopic data, where we can upload knowledge about where are inhibitory excitatory cells, where we can upload the data from the electroporations, etc. And that they're developing kind of tools kind of to statistically analyze connectivity patterns and to visualize potential connectivity diagrams, which then allow us and other researchers to really go in and test potential circuit arrangements of how that system may truly kind of biophysically, realistically kind of implement those computations we observe. Okay, so let me finally say, because this was all the tools we have for the larval zebrafish, which is very powerful and amazing and are used a lot. But I've told you that we really want to move midterm very soon to the slightly older animals, which have kind of more interesting behaviors. But there we actually don't have those tools yet, so we need to further improve those existing tools. And let me just briefly show you kind of one strategy of how we kind of trying to understand kind of the neural basis of behavior in those animals. And this brings us kind of back to this idea I showed to you in the beginning, of that we can, in our behavior tracking system, have a freely swimming fish and present visual stimuli locked to the body orientation and to the position of the animal in closed loop, so keep it constant over extended periods of time. So I've shown you this movie where the poor fish is swimming around happily and being presented with motion drift to the left all the time, which has been really powerful to investigate the ability to integrate, but which is also really powerful for us because we know that whatever neuron is currently doing the sensory processing, it should also be active over extended periods of time. And this allows us to kind of use now tools for molecular biology, where we know that if a neuron is active and calcium goes into the cell, many gene regulatory proteins are being modulated and changed. And this is possible now to exploit this because we have specific antibodies for some of them, which allow us to kind of use antibody stainings to then indirectly find out which neuron has been active a few minutes before the animal died. And the powerful property here is that this doesn't require the animal to be transgenic. This just work. This will definitely work in also older animals. It doesn't require complicated head fixation procedures. It just requires that the stimulus is constant over a few minutes, which we can very easily create in our virtual environment. And so we've tried this already with our motion stimulus. So when we present the animal with constant leftward motion, or with constant rightward motion, or with constant forward or constant backward motion, then we can develop statistical tools to ask really on the pixel-to-pixel level, kind of between the different groups, what has changed. And what we find is that really, very interesting, I mean, it doesn't have to be like this, but it's like this, that the kind of left side of the brain is active when the animal sees motion to the left, and the right side of the brain is active when the animal sees motion to the right. And interestingly, kind of the forebrain is active when the animal sees motion to the front. So kind of this tool we know, so now it works, and can apply this to various kind of various scenarios. So for example here, we said, okay, what's now brain activity difference in animals which are which were raised in isolation or which were raised in kind of densely populated groups. Can do the same thing, let the animal swim in this configuration for extended periods of time, perform these immunostainings, do the statistical analysis, and we also find a brain region which seem to be upregulated when animals are in a group. So the method works. I mean, we've tested this now so far only in larvae, but now we're bringing this to our juvenile experiment where we can do more complicated behavioral experiments. And this requires us to kind of now employ whole body clearing methods because it's a much bigger sample and we want to image deeper into the tissue, and the fish essentially through the clearing completely disappeared. And what you're seeing here you're seeing that the green neuron, the green cells, which are kind of here, this green layer, this is cells which just have been active before the animal was sacrificed, and red is all neurons. So in principle, we can now do statistical analysis with those older animals. And again, I told you that kind of the beauty of the system is that this is universal. So it's not tied to our juvenile zebrafish. It also works in other fish species or kind of in insects. And we are intensively collaborating with other members of the cluster in order to develop these technologies and share these ideas across labs. And finally, we also hope to use this to employ this technique to work in a collaboration with Ian and Daniel, where now they've discover this interesting phenomena that when you kind of put the animal in a conflict where the animal can either follow a conspecific cue in its environment or follow kind of global motion drift, then the focal fish seems to occasionally switch. So it's switching from long periods of time to following the social cue, and then at some point it decides to follow the environmental cue. And now the question is kind of in these long extended switching periods, do we find different brain states? And now with this tool in hand, we will be able now to fixate, to just have the animal in a certain state, fixate the animal, and then compare brain activities and thereby potentially identify the different brain centers responsible for these different behavioral states. Okay, let me wrap up. So we really want to understand is how the sensory environment is transformed into behavior. And I've talked at a large focus of what we do is kind of exploring the computations, the algorithms of behavior, but that we aim to link kind of these algorithms of behavior to the neural implementation. And eventually, kind of things are then kind of even more complicated, that in the animals are not alone, so they're interacting in groups with creating these complicated feedback loops from the behavior of one animal to the sensory stimulation to the other. And by rigorously trying to explore this processing in the individuals and how behavior is shaped by conspecifics, we hopefully long distance should be able to fully understand this complicated system. Okay, which then hopefully will us allow to really pin going down into the kind of into the nervous system of what animals are doing in these complex groups, and allow us to kind of better explain these complex emergent properties of collective behavior. Okay, and so let me finally thank again the cluster for support and for funding large parts of these projects, and my wonderful group, which is a lot of fun to work with these highly motivated people, and my other collaborators in the cluster and in the New Biology, and thank you for your attention. I'm repeating the question. The question is so the ontogeny of phototaxis behavior, so the ontogeny of the question is the animal changing its light-seeking behavior over development, yes or no? And if so, could this be kind of a trick? Could we employ this as a tool to ask are there different kind of neural populations involved or not? And so the answer is yes, it does change. So there is some evidence that older animals are actually switching from light seeking to dark seeking. And now, and one question which we are trying to address is now, if you now characterize kind of the switch of the optomotor response in individuals and the switch of the photo kind of light seeking behavior, then the question is this in an individual happening at the same time? And if so, it may be indicative of that this is perhaps the same kind of neural substrate. And if not, you kind of think you have pretty much guaranteed that these are different structures. And we are looking exactly at kind of this transition of behaviors across kind of with different visual stimuli. Yeah,
thanks. Very fascinating system. It's a very basic question, because I was wondering when you showed the ontogeny and the difference of the larvae of 7 days and then 14 days, whether or not their behavior is not in a way extremely similar and can be interpreted as an anti-predator strategy. Because if I'm transparent, of course, being cryptic and isolated is a similar anti-predator defense as if I'm dark and then seek the safety in numbers. And so this, would you expect that the neurons you are looking for are the same and just switch when the individuals realize that they are getting darker, seek camouflage in darkness? Or would you, I mean, you showed this kind of linearity as if it would be a learning process, but to me it seems the same thing, just an adaptation to an anti-predator strategy.
I mean, in fact, I mean, from neurobiological work, we know that even at a very young age, when they are largely ignoring each other, they can already sense each other. They know where the other animals are, and this is the same brain region, which has then also been found in older animals. So yes, so from the perceptual level, it seems like all is in place already at that very young age, but they, for some reasons, seem to ignore this. And probably it's kind of it is just evolutionarily not advantageous as a tiny larvae, kind of to be in kind of a close group, which is probably kind of decreasing your likelihood of survival. And one hope we have is that we can perhaps even through kind of putting the animals in a different context may change that behavior such that even the young animals may want to kind of be together with their conspecifics, and then kind of let us kind of explore kind of social behaviors in this tiny animal. But so how does switch from larvae to older animal occur kind of on the neuronal level, we don't know. We know it happens. We don't know why it happens, and we don't know what could trigger it. I mean, one question could really be, is this really just happening just over development, or is there a certain trigger? Do other animals have to be around in order for this to happen? Does this happen also when animals are in isolation? Kind of all these questions can kind of be addressed with these ontogeny experiments.
Thanks for your talk, Armin. So I've got a question on the paralyzing experiments. Mm-hmm. So you were showing us at the beginning that the animal is freaking out in open loop experiments. mm-hmm. because its actions is not causing
I
any
did,
effect
yeah.
on the
yes,
visual
exactly right, yeah.
environment.
Yeah.
So now if you paralyze the animal, I think you will open the loop even further, right? Because
well,
it's not getting any inference copy of its decisions, basically. So do you think this will become a problem in your experiments by just creating more events of the animal freaking out, but now just like on a neural basis?
So it would definitely become a problem if we haven't thought about it. So there is a kind of a lot of work actually which shows that if you do not give the animal agency kind of over the surround, if you just have the head fixed animals sitting there and watching, kind of watching motion to the right or to the left, and not allowing the animal, kind of not letting the behavior to interfere with this, then the animal will try harder and harder and harder, and eventually will realize no matter what I do, it doesn't matter, and gives up behaving to begin with. So this is why it's critically important to have this tiny arrow here, which from the recordings of the behavior, we do actually present, we update the visual stimulus in such a way that the animal is getting the expected feedback. So when the animal swims to the right, the world will move to the left. When the animal swims to the left, the world will to the right. When there is a certain strong motion stimulus and the animal does something, we'll stop the stimulus. So to really give the animal agency, because otherwise there would just be this total this disconnect, and the animal would refrain from behaving. So we take this into account.
So do you think this freaking out behavior is an active decision of giving up?
Mm-hmm.
That you could also investigate, or?
Well, it is being investigated by others, and it is actually really interesting, very interesting behaviors. It's yet another integrator sitting somewhere in the fish brain, which, so when the animal is realizing it can't achieve what it wants to achieve, it's trying harder and harder, and there's an integrator, kind of a motor integrator, which integrates now over time kind of this behavior. And at some point there is a threshold reached, which then this system is releasing some inhibitory substance across the entire nervous system and shutting down the behavior over extended periods of time. And this is being studied intensively. It's a very exciting system, but we may not want to tap into that.
No. Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is really exciting stuff. Different classes of decisions that all seem to follow this integrator model quite well.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if there are any other kind of decision behaviors in this species that might not follow that pattern.
Mm-hmm. So the question is if there is more types of decisions that do not follow that pattern. Yes, I mean, the question comes, what is the decision at the end, no? And so I loosely define a decision of kind of a binary behavior, either going to the right or to the left, and no matter what stimulus you find which would elicit this, I could call a decision. So we know for this, so people have looked at what's called kind of predator avoidance behavior, where it can also be called a decision. So you have a kind of a looming stimulus which is approaching the animal, and then normally the animal swims away. And what happens now if you have two looming stimuli at the same time? Then the animal needs to make a decision whether it should swim to the right or to the left. So this is being studied. You can then start exploring this all in these older animals, right? If you have two equally interesting food sources, which are equally distant, you could ask which one is the animal going for. This is called a decision. So I think there's an infinite space of possible behavioral paradigms, which we are really limited with in the larval system because, yeah, we're just excited to have one or two now. But with the juvenile systems, I think this will be a kind of a very open field of behavioral explorations. Yeah, and
cool.
Let's give a round of applause to Armin for this talk.